Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k.
Chris, welcome to the show. Good to have you. How are you?
Good. How are you, Devin?
Doing great, man. Thanks for jumping on today. Look forward to diving into some talk and shop about real estate here. Let's kind of go big picture for somebody listening, watching that hasn't met you before. How did you get into this entrepreneurial game?
Oh, that's a great question. Now, I kind of joke, my wife's part to blame, but also one of my employers. So reason I say that, I've been in real estate since 1997, aged myself, graduated college, started working for a commercial general contractor. Now, as project manager, for people who kind of don't understand that, I'm the guy in the white shirt and tie on the construction site who looks like they don't, looks like we don't do anything.
They got actually a clipboard, maybe?
Yeah. So back in the day, it was a clipboard. Then you got an iPad or a Palm Pilot was back
that,
then.
Yeah. That was king for a while. What market was that in that you were doing that?
So it was up in Boston, up in the Northeast. So heavy union market.
Oh, man. Yeah.
So learned a ton. Awesome experience. Learned, worked for some really smart people. And the company, when I started with them, went from about $100 million up to now they're, I think, at like $6 billion. It's one of the largest contractors in the country. Wow. The owner, smart, smart guy. He was a madman, entrepreneur type. But I did that for 15 years. And then he got burnt out, working 6 days a week. I also, during that time, moved down to the DC area. Then I flipped. And for people who work on general contractor, they call it moving to the dark side. Because I moved to the dark side by working for a real estate developer.
Right. Yeah. Those evil capitalists.
Yep. Those evil capitalists. And that's where I started getting really the entrepreneur. I'll call it my prior life. I just worked so much. I didn't have time to do anything else. Then when I started working for a developer, one of the first questions my boss asked me at the time was, what do you got for real estate? What are you going to do to retire? And I'm like, oh, I got my 401k. And he just starts laughing at me. I mean, just like, are you serious? He's like, you got to start owning some of your own real estate. And then I started looking at it. I'm like, yeah, kind of 401k. And somebody mentioned the 40-40-40 rule, which is you work 40 hours a week for 40 years to get 40% of your income, which you can never retire.
Yep.
So my real estate journey then started. My wife and I built our primary residence and we acted as a GC. It was 2013. We're down in DC area now. We're 8 miles from DC. We have a 1 acre lot. So prime piece of real estate. And we had the contractors, the subs begging for work because it was still slow at the time where they're trying to make payroll and still pay the bills.
Yeah. So what year was this?
2013.
Gotcha.
So 10 years ago.
Yep.
So we basically built it. And when we were done, we had probably about 40% equity, because of GCing it ourselves. Plus the market in that time just started really to ramp up. We actually bought the property in 2012, lived in it for a year, designed it and did all that fun stuff. So with that equity, we started buying some rentals that we could rehab in the Washington, D.C. area. Unfortunately, just like most major markets, we were both working W-2s, way too competitive. So after two deals, we had two kids at the time as well, which we still do. My wife's like, we just can't do this anymore. Mm. So I stumbled upon mortgage note investing, which is what I do now. Most people don't even know this exists. People hear about private lending or seller finance.
Yep.
But mortgage note investing is when you're buying those loans on the secondary market that you're really not originating. You're buying them 5-10 years down the road. And we focus a lot on the distress side
of
the market. So started getting in that in 2016, bought my first loan in 2017 and grew that, started doing some small syndications with that and left my job last year to, we're raising $150 million now, go big or go home, some would say, to raise money in a mortgage note fund.
Man, that's awesome. There's so much I want to dive into there. So you're doing a fund like an evergreen fund with $150 million cap, or what are you guys doing on the fund side?
Yep. So it's an evergreen fund, and we have two conduits to get into the fund, which is also very unusual. We did a Regulation A offering, which most people may not be familiar with. Most people hear the Reg D. On the Regulation A, you get qualified by the SEC. So you have to go through a lot of hoops, and it's much more expensive than a Reg D. It's probably 10x the cost.
And you're talking for the sponsor.
For the sponsor, yes.
Yeah.
So we
and some time too, right? I mean, how long does it take to get the Reg A done?
It's not as slow as people think. It takes about 3 months to get qualified by the SEC. And it took us, give you an idea, we started planning it in November. We got qualified in July. So it does take longer. But the benefit of that is you can raise money from anybody over the age of 18, accredited, non-accredited.
Relationship, no relationship.
No relationship. Know. So that's the benefit. Yeah. And when on a mortgage note fund, for example, we don't take on debt. So we don't have leverage because we are the bank. So if you're doing a multifamily deal, Devin, and you're saying, hey, we're going to get 65% leverage on this deal and 5-year exit at a 15, 18% IRR, we can't compete on that level because we're not taking on debt. So we look
at it. It's a different risk profile too, right?
Exactly. It's a different risk profile. But in the same token, a lot of the accredited real estate investors, they're chasing that yield. So some want that stability of lower risk, but also there's a lot of other people, I'll call it the normal Americans, who are just working in 9 to 5. When you tell them like 17%, a lot of them are like, there's no way you could get that on a real estate deal. So, you know, we offer 8 to 11% returns. And some people at that point in time still say, you're out to lunch. There's no way you can meet that.
So interesting. Because
it's so interesting. Yeah.
10% return on real estate to me, especially within like a no debt position, that is fantastic, right? But totally achievable too.
It's absolutely achievable. But you have some people who will laugh at it, says, I don't get out of bed for X amount. And then you have some people say, there's no way you could provide that type of return.
Right. You know, so fascinating. Yeah. And what's interesting is of the investable population, the population that has maybe some capital to invest, and you and I might go on podcasts, talk about this stuff all day, do it every day. We're still addressing like the tiniest fraction of kind of the addressable investor market, right? We're still dealing with this alternative asset class where you might have to explain a 10% return to somebody. That's crazy, but that's the reality of it.
Yeah. And for us, we also have to explain not only the return, but what it is we do, because most people think, oh, you're buying the property. We're like, no, we're not. We're just going to use Wells Fargo as an example. You pay Wells Fargo every month. Instead of paying Wells Fargo, you're just paying 7E. We're just stepping in on that lender profile. So by doing that Reg A, it did allow us a much more greater audience where you can raise $75 million a year. We also do have a Reg D component as well that has some different terms. And
506C?
506C.
Yeah.
And we also broke it up because we also been working with broker dealer RAs and investment advisors, and they typically have all their clients are accredited, and for purposes of them, less risk for them, you know, they'll have their accredited investors invest in the Reg D for due diligence and other purposes that they don't want to take a non-accredited investor and then reference something. And God forbid it ever goes bad. And they might get a complaint against them or whatever that might be.
So the broker dealers feel a different level of comfort with a 506C Reg D offer or Reg C offering?
It depends. Some like the Reg A and some like the Reg D. It's really weird. And it's kind of, it's also that divide of, I'll say, old school versus new school.
Interesting. Okay. You know, so who the younger guys prefer which?
Reg A.
Yeah. It's newer. It's a newer legislation. It's a newer... Yep. Yeah, that's
newer product, and it's still, you know, understanding laws and regulations behind it and the risk profile.
Yeah. What's been your experience? We've always done, I've been raising capital for about a decade, always done 506C, 506B, direct kind of to investor, have not done any really big family office, big check writers, have not done any kind of equity partners, have not done any broker dealer stuff. What's been your experience working with those guys? It kind of a net positive? I mean, there's trade-offs, I'm sure, but how's that been for your team?
Yeah, we literally just started. Well, we started the process in January.
Okay, cool.
But it's not like you can just flip a switch and they start. Of course. Now, there's a long vetting process that they have to do.
Yep.
It's a lot more in depth. And for example, the due diligence side, they will tell you, you got to go get a third party company to do a report on you. So there's three companies, Buttonwood, FactRight, and the other one's like Mick something. These companies, which you as a sponsor pay for this report, which is called $25,000. So it isn't cheap.
No kidding. For like this is intense. The credit and criminal and...
Oh no, this is like literally, they send you like a 20-page questionnaire of everything from criminal, all the background checks on you, the company. Do you have a succession plan? Do you have audited financials? How much of your portfolio is bought from some of your other portfolios? What's your investor profile? What's your risk profile? Are you all in one asset? Are you diversified? What they will ask you to, they will take a look at your pro forma and they will pick it apart. Like, why did you assume, let's just say you were doing a rental property. Why did you assume absorption of X amount of units per month? Why did you assume you could get an extra $100 per month? Us on the notes, it's how did you assume how quickly you can get the money out the door? How did you assume your return profiles on performing versus non-performing? It took about, started in March and we got the report in June. Give you an idea of, and they have three basically people almost working full time and they're just firing questions back at you. Yeah. And the reason they do this is, A, it's good for as a sponsor to understand what they look for.
Right.
But essentially, you know what a PPM looks like in a subscription agreement, everything else.
Yeah, monstrous.
Yeah, these people, they don't want to, and think of a family office. How many PPMs do you think they get thrown on your desk every day?
100,000.
Yeah. So they need somebody, they want somebody to do the first scrub. And if somebody's going to spend 25,000 bucks to get a scrub, they're like, okay, this person at least did it. And they'll put a report that has recommendations, but actually not recommendations. It has basically pros and cons of the offering. They don't tell you whether or not you should invest. They said, here are the risks involved. Here are some of the pros that are involved with it. So at least it's kind of like your Reader's Digest summary of the offering that they can at least do that first round of check before they start diving deeper and want to get meetings with you. So it's much like dating, the process. A lot of investors, they pull the trigger pretty quickly. You might talk to an investor, they're looking to invest. When you're dealing with that RIA investment advisor type group, it will take 3 to 6 months of the dating before they get behind you and basically like, okay, I'll start seeing if some of my people who work with me are considering investing.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's just a totally different model. I appreciate you breaking that down. That's obviously a different track, but there's unlimited amount of capital out there for these deals. Just kind of figuring out how you're going to go connect the dots. We started kind of big picture on the fund, and I appreciate you breaking down the Reg A and how you guys are approaching the Reg D and the investment advisors and working with them. Let's get down a little more tactical to mortgage note investing. We hold a ton of land owner finance notes. I like that model. We originate them and we hold them forever. So we've got some experience there, but buying a seasoned note on a secondary market, that's cool. That's interesting. I'd love to learn more about that. And then I also want to kind of understand what your triggers are. You said distress, right? So is there some kind of a trigger on a late payment or a default? I just want to dive in on that. I just haven't really explored that world at all. So I'm curious to see how all that works.
Yeah. So when people think of distress, this is always what blows people's minds. Like if somebody's driving right now, they just kind of like get shooken back when most people think you miss one payment and it's like, oh my God, they're going to come banging on my door and foreclose on my house.
Yep.
We deal with the loans that we see. Average delinquency, I'd say, is about 5 years. We got some that are 10, some that are 2.
Fully delinquent for 5 years?
Yeah.
So what kind of assets are these?
Now, single family residential. Most are single family residential. We've got one now that is, they haven't made a payment in 11 years. And what happens a lot of times is the funds that hold them, basically, they have so many loans.
Right.
A lot of times they just stick them in a drawer. And literally don't do anything, or they're like, we're not going to spend any more money on this, or whatever the case may be, or we're going to put it out for sale. And the moment somebody puts it out for sale, they just stop doing everything on it.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's a lost cause at that point.
It's a lost cause. So I always start with that, because that usually people are like, how can people go years without paying their mortgage? And they can. It's blows people's minds. Now, next question is, well, why would you buy something like that? Of course.
Yeah.
And it's because we can buy it at a significant discount. Think of, we always like to use the equivalent of buying a property that is dilapidated and needs a lot of work. You know, right. You're not paying market rate for that property. You're going to buy the property, try and rehab it, fix it up, and resell it. But a mortgage note is very similar. The only difference is you're not rehabbing the property, you're rehabbing the borrower. And what we mean by that is we're trying to get them on a new payment plan. We're trying to get them to come to the table because you also buy it at a steep discount. You yeah. have more flexibility and able to work some of the numbers.
Now, so let me ask you a question real quick on, let's say you've got a note that was originated $100,000 on a single family home, just easy numbers. If it's 5-10 years old, these are amortizing, right? So maybe it's yep. paid down, maybe it's 75K, just easy yep. numbers. So mm-hmm. if the outstanding mortgage balance is 75,000, what is a substantial discount? Is it 80%? Is it half? Is it less? Is it a huge range? Where are you looking for that?
It's a range by the state. And let's just, to keep it even simpler, let's say the current balance is, let's say start at 125, today it's 100,000.
Sure.
We would pay anywhere from $30,000 to $70,000 for that note.
Okay. Yeah, it's a big range. Yeah.
30 to 70, and it really depends on the state.
Is that right? What is the state dictating there?
Foreclosure timelines.
Okay.
So there's two types of states, judicial, which means you have to go through the court system, which means okay. time, or non-judicial, which means you just file in the newspaper and basically you can redeem your rights. For example, New York or Hawaii, it could take 5 years to foreclose in those states.
Absolutely incredible. By law, every house in the state.
Yep.
5 years.
Now, some people, what they'll do is they'll go through the federal court, which can get it done in like 18 months, but there's other ramifications.
I'm
then
sure.
you go to other states like Georgia, Texas, those states, 3 to 4 months.
Yep. Sounds about right.
And most yep. states are around a year. So up the East Coast, Florida, Carolinas, Maryland, Virginia's a little quicker, mid-central part of the country. Usually it's about a year is what typically it will take to foreclose on a property.
That's interesting. And that's a mix of judicial and non-judicial states. And you're kind of, yeah, it's about a year.
Yep.
You guys are looking at a note for sale. By the time the fund or bank or whatever puts it up for sale, they're kind of done with it. And then what is your kind of criteria to say, yeah, mm-hmm. that's something we're going to take a risk on and bite off on? Is there a ton of due diligence or are there kind of some easy check boxes that you guys can look at to say, yeah, that's something we'd pursue? Because you're doing, I mean, what's an average note purchase here? Is it 100 grand? Is it 500 grand? And if you're looking to deploy 150 million, that's a lot of volume, yeah. right?
Yeah, it is. So right now, our average note is a little over 100,000 today.
Right. Yep.
And the property value behind it's roughly about 300,000. So you can see yeah. kind of when you talk about risk, we've got plenty of equity in today's values in these properties.
Because you got a first lien mortgage that you either you're taking ownership of correct. On an asset that is, man, I mean, it's 40% loan to value.
And again, we like buying loans that are like 10 years old because what was the value of a house 10 years ago compared yep. to today?
No doubt.
Loans yeah. that people just bought last year or the year before,
probably
we're not a big fan yeah. of because there's not equity in a lot of those deals.
Yeah.
Typically, our buy box is property values over $100,000. We like to, I mean, we've invested in 40 states. We typically won't buy in New York, very rare, unless it's part of a large pool
sure.
that we'll buy in. And we look at kind of three things. We look at the property value. We look at kind of the predicament, what caused them. Usually it's death, right. divorce, or job loss.
Yeah.
Sometimes people just stop paying. It's rare, but it happens.
Well, once they hear this podcast, they know they can not pay for 10 years.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
that's crazy.
But we also look at, for example, if somebody's filed bankruptcy 5 times, we're not buying that note.
Yeah,
they know right. somebody knows how to game the system.
The pros.
But we look at, again, like Georgia or Texas. If the person hasn't paid in 7 years in Georgia or Texas, a red light goes off in our heads. They've been able to game the system somehow because that probably yep. should have been foreclosed upon by now.
Interesting.
Now, same property in Florida and it was 2 years old. Okay, it just takes longer in Florida and they maybe contested the foreclosure and that happens a lot. But those are some of the initial red flags.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of Creating Wealth Simplified. We wanted to take a moment and tell you more about our passive income fund at 7E, which is open to both accredited and non-accredited investors. Our latest offering targets an 8% annual return distributed monthly with the ability to potentially achieve a greater return through our bonus share program. If you'd like more information, reach out to us at invest@70investments.com to learn more. Thank you.
Okay, so the fund's getting to 100, kind of evergreen, getting to 150 million. What does the team look like And what does the kind of the trend, probably pretty heavy on the transaction side, right? Is there kind of like an acquisitions manager running through this, or give me the idea of what kind of volume you need to kind of do to make it work for you guys on the, I guess the purchase side, right?
Yeah. So, well, we have a team of 9 overall.
Yep.
Now, but we have also outsource a lot of components. For example, we don't speak to borrowers. We use a licensed servicing company that, and I know you hold some loans. I don't know if you collect the payments or
not at all. Third party, and they pay for it.
Yeah. So similar where on us, we have to pay for it on single family. Sure. You can't make the borrower, but we have companies who do all that tax reporting for the borrowers, 1098s and stuff. So we use that servicer, but we have myself and another person lead up acquisitions. And right now we're buying about 2 to 3 million a month is what we're buying in loans.
Okay. That might be 20 plus notes in a month.
Yeah, it's 10 to 20. So as the fund has grown, the average price has grown. When we started out and we were raising, you know, a few million dollars, we were buying lower dollar assets, you know, or lower balance assets, not dollar. And then as we've grown, we've been able to increase the size as well. So it's 2 of us on the acquisitions, and then we have 2 people kind of on the asset management side of things.
Right.
Also who basically manage the assets through that period of time. And they're the ones managing the servicers, managing the attorneys, and software is critical.
No doubt.
Having good software that can track all this for you to let you know when you're going to do all your follow-ups saves a significant amount of people. And we have an accountant, and we have 3 people on investor relations and marketing for raising the fund side of things. So it's interesting that some companies like ours, they outsource a lot of that asset management. For us, we go by the philosophy of nobody manages their money or their assets better than themselves. So we like to keep it all in-house.
It seems like for what you're doing, that's kind of the real work, right? I mean, you've got some process on the acquisition side, identifying it, but then doing the workouts, I imagine, is pretty involved, right? If you're trying to restructure payments or that seems kind of like the bulk of the work from what I'm hearing.
It is. And it's interesting though, because again, we have pro forma calculators that, okay, we bought this loan at $50,000. They owe 100. Their payment was $900 a month. Can we do $700 a month? Or we just plug it into our calculator and and it spits out green means go if it meets a specific IRR we're targeting.
Yep.
And yeah, we can make that number work, and we'll provide. Typically, we like to be at the forefront of providing the options to the borrower of, hey, here's what it is. But we also get a lot of information from them. They call it a shock package, which is just like applying for a loan. Give me your tax return. Give me your pay stubs, and kind of we'll pull credit on you, and we'll work with you to try and see what you can afford. Now, they think we're adversarial because it's a conflict-oriented business, and that we're trying to screw them, where really we're not. We're actually trying to help them, because if I wanted their property, I would be out there buying real estate. I'm buying the notes because, you know, and I had a conversation. A borrower actually called me, got my number, and they're in Wisconsin. And, you know, I was joking with him. I said, hey, look, I'm in Virginia. Do you really think I want a property up in Wisconsin at this point in time? I'm like,
run a big company.
I just want you to pay your mortgage. I don't need a $125,000 house in Wisconsin. That, what am I going to do with it? I want you to keep your house, grow some equity in it, and then basically at some point in time, sell it and keep that money.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I wanted to ask about that. Let's say you get a house that's market value $300,000. Maybe you've got some repairs and exit costs that puts it at $250,000, just give you a wide margin. And you've got a note for $100,000 that you're on your balance sheet, you're in it for $100,000. So you get potentially $150,000 there of equity that you could capture in that first lien by forcing a foreclosure. But even then, you're still saying like, hey, it's different market, rehabs, repairs, exit headache, just not worth it pretty much all the time.
Well, last 3 years, and here's one of the things that we have to educate people on. A foreclosure is really a sale of the property. So it gets sold, and if the property sells at auction for $250,000, we're owed $150,000. We just get the $150,000, and any junior lien holders or the homeowner gets that extra money.
Yeah.
And that's where we've seen a lot of assets. But we've had assets in the past that we bid $100,000 at auction, nobody bid on it. And then all of a sudden we get an agent, we finally can get inside that property, and we may have to evict the person. And then we get in there and they're like, oh, you can sell this for $160,000, $170,000. And we're like, great, thank you. So there are times we can recapture it, but that's not something that was part of our pro forma that we anticipate.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, cool. Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. So are you guys solely focused now on this asset class? Sounds like the team is pretty much purpose built on executing here, right? with this one.
And we left the fund some wiggle room that we can invest in some single families or some small multifamilies or other types of asset class.
Yep.
And really reason why is if the market dries up completely and we have this money, we need to put it to use.
Yes.
Now, we're very cognizant of being strategic in that. I have a background from my past life in development, single family, multifamily. I have that background, but I'm not going to all of a sudden turn and go to oil and gas as an example.
Right.
Now, I see some people sometimes with their funds, when one thing dries up, they're chasing the next big thing.
Yeah, I've seen it, sure.
So for us, we're strictly, we want to be the best at what we do. So that's why our primary focus is on that first position mortgage notes.
Yep, makes sense. But you do have to, we just launched a fund, I guess, late last year, but I resisted it for years and years and years because it's like, hey, I don't want to have $10 or $20 million of capital accruing a distribution where I can't deploy it. Finally, we're at the scale where I feel comfortable in deploying it. So we did it and it's great, but that's a huge concern as a fund operator is like, we've got to be able to deploy this thing. So yeah, you've got to be able to have some kind of other avenues if the market changes. Couple questions about current market, but I do want to dive in a little bit more on the fund. What does somebody brings like 100K and says, hey, Chris, want to deploy 100K in your fund. What does that person expect? Is it accruing day one? What's the process? What's the lockup and all that kind of stuff?
Yep. So in the Reg A, it's a 4-year lockup within the fund, and it starts accruing on the first day of the following month. So today we're in July. So on August 1st, it would start accruing. September 1st, you would get your distribution for that month. So
cool. So it's like, you invest on the 15th and next month, you're getting a payout.
Yep. Cool. So you get your payout. And depending on the investment, it's anywhere from, it's a fix between 8 and 11. And the higher the investment, the higher the rate you get. We give what's called bonus shares. So we're selling actually shares of a company that you're buying. It's $10 a share. So 100,000, you're getting 10,000 shares. Mm-hmm. But as part of that, you get specific bonus shares with that, which I honestly, off the top of my head, can't recall what it is on the bonus share side, but it enhances the return. So at the end of 4 years, basically when you cash out your shares, you get over 100,000 plus those other bonus shares. Now you get the money from those as well. And those during that time are also accruing that distribution. So tried to keep it very simple. We don't have a drip, which is direct reinvestment, because then you start getting in the partial shares. And honestly, the SEC isn't a big fan of it.
People have asked about that in our fund and our stuff. And it's like the accounting requirement there, kind of from an operator side, like that's just a non-starter.
Yep.
And I wasn't aware the SEC is not. Why is the SEC frown on it?
It's more because the SEC wants essentially everybody to be on level playing fields. So like we tried to only give bonus shares to like the first $10 or $20 million of investments. They're like, nope, can't do that. And some people do it. But like you said, the accounting side of it as well is a nightmare in regards to who's in, who's out. And especially if there's any type of equity ownership, equity percentages. And then, so it can get, I mean, you'll have your accountants probably wanting to pull their hair out. So for us, it's more.
We'll hire four more people.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. And keep it simple. Basically, what we've always found, and I did a drip once in one of my old 506Cs.
Yeah.
And my CPA wanted to kill me because, and again, we used the bookkeeper and the software we used could calculate all of it.
Right.
Just, it's extremely challenging.
So many moving pieces. Yeah. What's the minimum investment in the fund? You guys doing 50K, 100K?
Five.
Oh my word. Could you imagine doing reinvestments on $5,000 across 1,000 investor positions?
So our initial investment when we started our Reg A,
was $500.
It was $500.
Yeah. Was your investor relations team poking their eyes out at that point? I mean, that's.
Yes. So the funny thing was people would ask like, well, $500, what's my return look like? And it's like $6 a month. They're like, well, that's nothing. And it's like, well, because you're only investing $500, you know, it was like $4, whatever it was.
Yeah.
But where it helped though was, and this is what we got to now $5,000, where it's nice is on these evergreen funds is without having that 100,000 or 50,000 min, people will basically, okay, I can risk $5,000 to see how things go.
Right.
And if things go well, next thing you know, we've had investors start with five and then cut us a check for 250 and just They want to see who you are, how you operate. So yep. that low barrier to entry gives people a little more confidence of, and if I was invested with you, Devin, at 50 grand, I'd be like, I'm confident, but also I'm nervous.
Sure, whereas
if you said, hey, I can get in with 5 grand and add more later,
yep.
it adds a lot more comfort.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think there's this inverse relationship a lot of times, not as a rule, but between kind of the investment amount and the client quality. You've got the $5,000 investor might be really, really concerned about it. And the $100,000 or $250,000 investor might write the check and forget about it because they're just different classes of investor. But I think there's really something to be said. And we kind of structured our firm the same way. It's like this network effect of if you can have investors in, show them a good experience. Yeah, it might be that, I mean, we have a $50,000 minimum, so we don't have a super low barrier to entry. But as these things go, it's relatively low. And we've kept it there because, sure, test it out for the lower amount, see how it goes, do a year in a project, and then do more if you're comfortable with it. But that network effect of being able to say, like, we really don't do any marketing outside of podcasts and some social media stuff, but you get those people in, show them a great experience, and then it kind of grows organically for there. So I would imagine having a lower barrier to entry, although that entails, I'm sure, a lot of extra work for your team, you're connecting with so many more folks now that potentially have the wherewithal to refer people, to grow their own investments with you. And that's huge.
That's where it's helped. Two parts, you hit the nail on the head there. One is people growing and referring to others. And then people yep. being also, okay, I have an IRA that's only got 7,000 bucks in it, or I have an HSA, or I have this, whatever it is, other types of accounts that they yep. can invest in that they don't might not have the 50 or that minimum that they can. So we see a lot of people like that also invest as well.
Well, I want to ask you about current market conditions. We're talking yep. in second half of 2023 right now. We're on the heels of 10 consecutive rate hikes. We're seeing all sort of impacts out there in the economy, and especially in real estate with rates in the sevens and eights and things like that. How's that impacting you guys? And obviously, you're looking at loans that originated sometimes years ago, but what's going on with current market climate? What's that doing to you guys? What are you seeing out there?
Yeah. So first, the interesting thing is our business gets better when the economy gets worse because there's more default typically.
Yep. More distress.
More distress. Interest rates don't have as much as an impact on us because we're not originate loans and then we'll call it Silicon Valley Bank. Oh, I have this loan at 4% and all of a sudden market's at 7%. We're buying at a discount to hit a certain yield in double digits. So, but what we're seeing in the market is definitely a lot of tightening on the lending side of things. And we're usually at the forefront. We see a lot of what's going on before. I'd say if you're investing in multifamily, we're seeing the defaults come away or the amount of loans for sale. And that's something we've seen a ton of lately. For the first quarter of the year, give people an idea, we probably were seeing about $100 million a month in loans come across our desk. The second quarter, we were seeing about $400 to $500 million. But we saw a significant uptick in the number of loans for sale.
Right.
And that's performing and non-performing. But a lot of them are loans that were, let's use the term scratch and dent, where they try and sell them to Fannie or Freddie and they're not qualifying. And all of a sudden, these companies are stuck with them.
Right.
And last year, those types of loans were selling at 90 something cents on the dollar. Now they're down in the 70s and 80s. Right. So we're starting to see things sell. So what we see, and I am a more of a gloom and doom type of person, just to be upfront.
Sure.
I see things getting worse before they get better.
Yeah.
I think real estate is a slow play where things take a while to happen. But I think the amount of credit card debt, people were taking out home equity lines of credit to pay off their credit cards and they max those out. We're seeing a lot of those now on the market for sale. The interest rates. And then I think on the investment side of things, it was so easy and people were just buying rental property or Airbnb properties and basing everything off of 2021 numbers or whatever case may be. And the people who don't have to move, of course, are not moving. I have a 3% rate on my house. I love my house anyways, but even if I didn't, I would never go anywhere because of that uptick. So the only properties I think we're going to see on the market are probably ones that may be in distress until it kind of tilts a little bit more to people forced to sell. But everybody knows what's going on in commercial multifamily, and that does have an impact on residential. So I'm not predicting like the world is going to end. I'm not predicting a 2008, but people who are continuing to bank on 5% rent increases and 5% appreciation, I would not be doing that. I would either anticipate being at flat or coming back down to earth, and depending on your market. I know certain markets erupted where I was in a group, somebody had a $400,000 house that's now worth $900,000. And it's in a market that I just don't see it being sustainable. It's a beautiful area, but there's not enough jobs or employment to be in that area. Those areas, just like 2008, certain areas that ramped up a lot got crushed, in those major metropolitan areas, they grew, but they didn't grow at absurd rates where when they did take the hit, they didn't take as big a fall. The more you rise, the harder the fall. I mean, that's the way I look at it.
I remember in 08, I was talking to a guy at a conference. This is years ago, but this house is a $100,000 house, I think in Las Vegas, and got up to $500,000. And then after the crash, like back under $100,000. It's like that, just wild, these wild swings. Yeah, it's interesting. I appreciate your feedback. And it does take a while for these things to kind of work through the system. It's just such an, I don't want to say unprecedented, but it's been a while since we had that kind of a hike over such a short period. And as we're talking now, inflation numbers seem to be getting to where they like them, if you believe the numbers. But anyway, always love to talk to different operators that are doing different things, especially you guys kind of all around the country. So appreciate that feedback. Well, let's kind of looking ahead. What do you see for the rest of the year for the team and what you guys kind of want to accomplish for the second half of 2023 here?
Yeah, for us, just continue to grow the company. And we are very focused on what our plan is, what our mission is. We follow, people heard of EOS and those types of systems.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you're part of any mentorship groups or subscribe to anything. EOS is a great system that a lot of people might know about.
Yeah, so EOS is kind of what we subscribe to, which the big focus for us on EOS is, I'll use the term, the accountability chart and your vision. Yeah. So basically creating the roadmap so everybody is on the same page where the company wants to go. And I work for two companies that were identical. One had a vision and one didn't. And the company culture was completely different from one to the other.
So fascinating.
So everybody had buy-in on the one that had the vision and the one that didn't. You'd have an annual review and they'd say, what's your goals? I'm like, well, I have no idea. What do you want me to do? Because the company doesn't have goals. And it was more, a lot more infighting of department to versus department. Whereas when there's a vision, everyone works together. But on the accountability side, what we noticed was, especially as a call ourselves a startup, because we've been doing note funds for years, but this is kind of, in the past, we had a lot less people where we have nine now. We'd have so many people dipping their hands in different roles. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, who's responsible for that? And then when you put one person in charge of, okay, this is what you're accountable for. And just because I'm the CEO, I may assist you on something, you're accountable, but I'm reporting to you on that task. And some people find that mind blowing. For example, we have acquisitions, woman who runs our acquisitions team.
Yep.
I help and I make the final decision, but getting to that point, she does a lot of the due diligence on those assets and puts together a sheet for me and gives it to me. So that's what we found to be the most impactful.
Yeah, I love it. Well, thanks for sharing that. Appreciate it. Well, Chris, awesome to meet you. Awesome to learn about your business. Really cool model that's different from what I've done. So I appreciate getting to learn about that and share with the audience. If somebody wants to connect with you and the team, how can they do that?
Yeah, email. You can email me at chris@7einvestments.com. And that's the number 7, the letter E, investments.com, or on our website, which is 7einvestments.com.
Awesome. We'll link to that in the show notes. If you're listening, you can scroll through and click right through and connect with Chris and team. Hey, man, it was awesome to learn from you and get to meet you. I wish you guys continued success. And thanks so much for joining today. Really appreciate it, Chris.
Well, thanks for having me, Devin.
All right. We'll see you. Take care.
Take care. Thanks.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show and leave us a review.